All right, everybody. Hello. Welcome back to Drat and Drake. Today, we have another guest with us, Dr. Nicole Martel-Moran. She's someone, actually, this is, I think, the first legitimate guest where I think this is our first time meeting. Most of our guests, really, I mean, thank you so much for trusting in our interview abilities to ask you these questions, because everyone else before were just friends or colleagues of ours. So thanks for, you know, taking the risk with us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
She is a veterinarian, graduated from Michigan State University in 2009, but at the same time, you finished a master's in public health, which I don't know how you did that. Resume is pages and pages long. You did some cool stuff with the Emergency Response Corps. You did primarily small animal. Now, you made the jump December 2012 from dogs and cats to then exclusively cat medicine. What made you do that?
Well, out of school, when I started practice, I kind of always knew that I liked cats and I was really into cats. And I love dogs, but cats and cat medicine just kind of resonated with me most. And I could see that was not the case with a lot of people. So, so it was my thing. I was always kind of known as the cat person in the clinic wherever I was working. And I was in Indianapolis. There was only one, maybe two tiny cat clinics, just one doctor practices. And so I was just kind of waiting to be able to get into one of those.
Oh, okay.
And just, you know, practicing and doing my cat thing at the other places. And finally, an opportunity opened up. It was for management, which only 4 years out of school was a bit of a challenge. That's all I ever wanted to do when I got out of school was, I'm like, man, I think cat practice would be perfect for me. And I started my journey as a manager,
that's
which
so funny.
I don't recommend.
Yeah. You know, my sister is also a vet, and, you know, you hear a lot of people their whole lives, they wanted to be veterinarians, kind of a broad topic. But for you, it's like, you've known you wanted to be a cat doctor.
Like I said, I love dogs and I still learned all the dog things. In my first practice, we saw just kind of whatever fit through the door. Saw a couple pigs, maybe one goat, one horse, but pocket pets, dogs, cats, ferrets, bunnies. So started out with that and then was just cat and dog and then just cats.
Okay. I mean, just chronologically going, I mean, tell me about juggling the cat exclusive medicine while also managing the practice. How did you do that? Or what was it like?
So it was difficult. It was a private practice that was purchased by a corporation. The veterinarian was retiring and I was theoretically taking his position. He was retiring and going out. We worked together for 2 weeks and then he left. And I had the practice.
What a contract this guy was able to sign.
I know. And he took everything with him too. He like took all the money out of the drawer. He took everything or like whatever.
Right.
Just, I don't care.
Okay. That's
just go.
Good
so
riddance.
Yeah, so I had to figure out how to manage the staff who, one, didn't know me, and two, graduating in the 1960s versus 2009, there's quite a practice difference. And so they didn't like me because I didn't practice the way that they were used to seeing. And I'm not saying bad or good, it was just different and they didn't like it. And it caused a big riff. And so eventually the only people that stuck with me were the licensed vet techs that were hired soon before me. Everybody else, I went on vacation and the manager, we had a hospital manager, she quit. And one of the receptionists quit and the other receptionist quit. And I came back and I had two vet techs and me. So we answered the phones, we saw the patients, and so it was rough for a couple years. And then, you know, we started to build the team around a more cat-friendly type of environment, and we got AHA accredited, and, you know, just introduced some, like, dental radiography, we got digital radiography, we got a anesthesia. We had when I got there, the like the Ohio 8 vaporizer or something from like the 40s. That was the vaporizer, and it had little like hash marks on it because it all wore off.
Oh wow. They use Ziploc bags and paper bags for like
in the little glass bottle, and it said ether halothane on it.
Wow.
Oh,
I hope you kept
got
that.
A new, and,
Make a
Like I should have
museum in the
kept the
corner
glass
of your
bottle, but
hospital.
I should have kept the glass bottle, but I was so irritated that I just like
Yeah, I bet in the time, especially if you graduated, according to most people, you're in your late 20s, taking over such a big responsibility, not getting the respect. Everyone's probably, I mean, everyone still says I look young, but to kind of get that level of disrespect, you're probably definitely over it by that time.
Yeah, I was kind of over it.
Are there any things that you can look at in retrospect with kind of being placed in management early on that you feel like really helped at this stage of your career that you kind of can appreciate, or was it for the most
Yeah.
part just not ideal?
No, I mean, I can absolutely take something positive out of everything. And for that position, it forced me to work on communication skills, which has always been difficult for me. I'm an only child. So it forced me to work on some communication skills and to think about things like that, to be able to manage client expectations and everybody's expectations, really, manage time a lot better at time management since that job. And then just appreciating the work that goes into running a clinic, really. Whenever I go into a new position, I have a lot of respect for the people that have to run it because I know how hard it is. So I try to make it easy on them
Yeah.
and not be a problem because I know how difficult it can be.
Yeah. Well, especially, after everyone sounds like left after you were on vacation, I feel like that's even more reason to really appreciate kind of the team that you do have and
Yeah.
the work they do and stuff. So.
The joke now is that they have, I have to leave a shoe whenever I leave so they know. I tell someone else, if you're going, you got to leave a shoe because you're not leaving.
I mean, wow, that's an experience, but I mean, it's impressive like that you got through it and now you're on the other side of it. And like you said, I think you can take good from any sort of bad situation and really turn that into a
It's a good, we had a
positive
good way of
thing.
looking into it. Now, not to list the corporate names specifically, we can leave them out of it, but were they quite supportive during this transition period for you and the growth period? Or were you also having another force kind of pushing down on you to have to please and make happy?
We came in at a point when they were acquiring a lot of new hospitals. So they were in the expansion phase of
Okay.
that point. So when I was brought on, there were people above me, but there wasn't a lot of support. I didn't know how to be a manager. I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing. So I just was just good luck. If you don't do it right, we'll send someone down to tell you you're doing a bad job. But
That was it. Okay.
yeah,
All
it's
right.
just kind of
Helpful.
a take a guess.
Okay. So pressure-wise, not at least not incredibly large amount of pressure from the above people.
No, there wasn't a lot of pressure, but I mean, when some things were going wrong, yeah, you'd get a visit and it's like, oh God, what am I doing wrong? I don't know how to fix it. And they're like, you have to fix your admin budget. I'm like, I don't even know what's in the admin budget. I
Didn't even know you had
don't even know what the budget was.
budget. Now, you mentioned that you ended up changing a lot of things and you used the term cat friendly. Now, I've never worked exclusively in a cat hospital. Can you expand on what that means?
Sure. So I think the first shift was to do away with scruffing the best you can. Cats, even though they tend to freeze when you do it, it doesn't mean it's good for the cat. And then kind of those little clippy things too, they put like
Oh,
on
yeah.
the
Little hair tie, little hair clips that people.
cats might freeze when they do it, but if you understand cat body language, you can see in their face that they're terrified and they don't like it. So that was quite a shift, but luckily the vet techs that I was left with were very open. And so once people started coming on, they trained people and taught them how to handle cats with like towels and, distractions without scruffing. So that was helpful. And then a big one that I focused on is I really like anesthesia and surgery. So I tried to focus on lower stress anesthesia and pre-medications and IV catheter placements instead of like laying on the cat to get that IV catheter in, give them a nice stroke
Boxing
setting,
them down.
boxing them down. That was a really hard one. I had so much pushback because we had a couple fill-in vets when I was there. That was a hard one to get out of everybody's thing. Like everybody had to leave before we could stop boxing cats down because I would not be there one day and they'd be boxing cats down. Like, what did I say?
It's incredible because, this was already a cat exclusive clinic you would expect, especially nowadays with the way us as vets, Remy and I mm-hmm. were raised. We were raised to know that scruffing and boxing down are a big no. But yeah, just even 10 years before that, standard of cat exclusive clinics.
Yeah. Yeah, and you see one cat do poorly and you'll never forget it, do it again. And it was never part of I didn't learn to box cats down, so I never did that. But I saw many people do it at other places and I just, it's not my job to tell you how to do it, so you do you. But yeah, they go down so fast and it's such a stressor to be like in this box and everybody's staring at you and like, oh my gosh, I'm breathing in this weird smelling gas. Of course they're gonna freak out.
Yeah.
But you know, I've seen a couple cats. Yeah, and I've seen a couple cats die. I mean, they have the fatal arrhythmia and they're in a box and you can't get to them. So now you have to take the box off. Everybody's exposed to gas. Everybody hold your breath.
Yep.
take the top off.
Or you
off
do it outside.
Right. You do it outside. Now you have your patient outside. Yeah. Oh, so geez. That was a hard one to break, but I think it's definitely helpful. And then, you know, waking up slowly and gently and in a quiet place. And for cats, it's great because there's no dogs barking. We have towel warmers, comfy beds and places for them to hide. So yeah.
Okay.
And even what I learned in 15 years, you know, now we have someone that came into the practice I'm at now and she's been out 5 years. Like what I do is archaic to her.
Oh, yeah.
Got all these new ideas.
Do you mind sharing which ideas? That's because I'm kind of on the same page with where you are right now. So what else to me, like what else could possibly be new?
I mean, I think she's more of a like, you know, examine them on the floor, you know, get on the floor with them and like examine them while they're walking around and, you know, that type of thing.
Okay. Yeah.
So even just small things like that,
fair,
I was like, oh,
fair.
No. Guess I could be doing that. And am I a horrible person because I immediately put them on the exam table? Right,
oh,
right.
No.
Well, I feel like you have to have a clinic environment tailored to that, right? Because not all hospitals are made to put a cat on the floor and not let them escape. But
I also have a bad back.
I was going to say my knees.
The floor is hard for me.
And just
unfortunately, I lifted a very large dog earlier in my career and my back is ruined.
Jeez.
Word to the wise. Yep. Protect your back.
Well, fortunately, there's no 100-pound cats.
No, I think 30 is the max.
Well, I've seen a couple of those for sure.
Yeah, there's some big ones. I mean, given the 15 years you've had within feline exclusive practice, I mean, are there any things that you feel most vets that are still working in the dog and cat world really just like aren't aware of that are either just like super big time savers or efficiency improving things working with cats that they just don't seem to be aware of? Do you see anything that people kind of consistently miss?
I would say two things. One's not really a time saver, but maybe for the cat, but yeah. I would say sedation. If you get a cat that comes in and they are freaked out, they're hissing, and you reach your hand in there and they're swiping, you're not going to get anything done with the cat. Just offer the sedation. You know, some people will say, here's some gabapentin, go home and give it and come back another day, which is fine too. But a lot of times the clients just want to get it over with. So just offer them the sedation. A lot of places have turned the clients away. Like, I don't want to see your cat. So then they come to us. Just give them some sedation. Just get it over with.
I literally had that case just the other week. One, we're both ER doctors, but one ER down the street didn't want to see it because the cat was fractious and they came to me.
Just give it the drugs.
Yeah, exactly. And it worked beautifully. Yeah. We got blood work. It went smoothly. Everyone was happy. It was nice.
The other one is I'm going to stretch for a time saver.
Yeah.
But vomiting cats, in the grand scheme of the cat's life, it will save you time to address the chronic vomiting when they're young instead of waiting till they're 15 and they have cancer.
It's a really good point.
So it will say it would technically save the veterinarian a lot of time over the cat's life, having to say, okay, your cat's vomiting. I don't know why, or vomits once a week. That's fine. And then all of a sudden they have, you know, from chronic inflammatory bowel disease, they have lymphoma down the road. Yeah. So cat's vomiting, they're still healthy. Address it then. That'll save you a lot of time.
Yeah, no, it's actually a really good one because you're the first person to like really exclusively pinpoint that as something that I would agree. I think it falls through the cracks a lot.
Yeah, I really like gastrointestinal health and medicine and the vomiting cat and all that stuff because I see it all the time.
Yeah,
every day, multiple times a day.
Yeah, you've mentioned, you know, congratulations on hitting 15 years of practice. You talked about your interest in kind of surgical procedures. I noticed rhinoscopy, endoscopy, all the skibbies. I mean, there's so many amazing skills that you've acquired. And of course, you have a certification in feline specialty. Tell me about that journey of getting these skills and instruments and even acquiring this pretty cool extra letters on your name.
So getting ABVP certified is quite a journey.
I have no idea. I'm incredibly ignorant, so please.
No, it's fine. So I was in practice for 8 or 9 years before I applied. I applied when I was out 5 years. That's like the minimum that you can apply for ABVP because it takes a couple years to get through the process. So at 5 years, I applied and I submitted case reports. You have to have 2 case reports, or now they have these like small case reviews that you can do where you can do 5 of them equals 1 case report. Okay. That sounds harder to me, but I don't know.
Yeah.
So I chose the 2 longer case reports. I submitted them and they both failed miserably.
Oh.
Of course, that's the point at which you're like, your confidence goes boom. I'm like, okay, yeah. I'm not going to do this again. I need a break. So I practiced for a couple years and got some more experience and then obtained a better case report. Okay. And was able to, I'm a little more educated on how to write a scientific paper better and how to manage the cases better. I just had more experience. And that one passed the first time. The second case report, I actually used a journal article that I had written about pain and adverse behavior in cats and declawed cats. So that was my second one. They allow you to use a research article as your second one if very you've cool. published.
Okay.
So I did that. And then you study for a big test.
Yeah. Okay.
The test is, it takes pretty much all day. You start in the morning and I believe there were 4 sections and they give you 2 to 3 hours per section. I believe it's 2 hours per section. At that time you went to the ABVP conference and you did it the day before the conference started. It took me 3 tries.
Okay.
I did not pass the first one. I didn't pass the second one. And of course I was mortified and so embarrassed.
Third time's a charm though, huh?
Yeah.
It was. Third time was a charm. So third time I passed it. Luckily the third time was during COVID. So everything was online.
Okay.
Awesome.
And that helped because I get a lot of test anxiety when there's people around and there's noises and whatnot. So I'm down in Houston. I went down to Galveston, which is like 45 minutes away, rented a little condo, an Airbnb on the water. And I opened up all the windows and I studied for 3 days. And that's where I took my tests and I finally passed it.
All right. Is it kind of, I know certain specialties, when you take those boards, if you fail one section, you have to retake the entire test. How does it work with feline specialty?
You have to take the whole test.
Ah, geez. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they're not divided into sections. Like the questions are just all mishmash and they're all in there. Yeah. Over. So I think you have to, they had that before where it was like a practical and then a different one. But now, yeah, I had to take the whole test.
Okay. Cool.
So then that was 2020 that I passed. And since then, as far as the endoscopy and rhinoscopy portion of it, I went to CSU Colorado and specific endoscopy training course, which was great. I highly recommend it. With the internists there, they did a great job.
Well, which internist? Dr. Webb?
Yes.
Love it.
And there was another one, I can't remember his name, older gentleman with glasses.
I did. I was only there for a year, for my clinical year.
No, glasses narrows it down.
I did see Dr. Webb. It was, I can't remember his name, but there was a couple. They were very good. We did rhinoscopy. We did everything. We did laparoscopy, rhinoscopy, endoscopy, GI, upper and lower, bronchoscopy. It was great.
Awesome. Yeah. Do you often, aside from just practicing those skills, is it necessary to have to kind of retake any of these classes or courses to kind of freshen up? Or oftentimes one is kind of pretty sufficient?
It definitely helps. One is good to get the muscle memory of the movements of using the scope. I think it's helpful to do. They have, CSU has a lot of online CE videos to get more information and more knowledge about what you're looking for and things you might see and how to address them.
Okay.
But yeah, I think it's definitely helpful to keep doing that. And also there's a textbook for endoscopy too, just flipping through the pictures and getting used to what they look like. It's something you have to keep up with, because in the beginning I was doing tons of endoscopy, and then you'll get like a lull for 6 to 8 months where there's nothing. Right. And then you'll get like eight in a row.
Brush off the dust on your endoscopy machine.
I gotta brush off the dust.
Do you feel it makes a pretty dramatic difference as far as how your case management goes, being able to do endoscopy in cats? Like, do you feel like it has a pretty massive change in how you're managing them? Or is it just like another good tool to have in the toolbox?
I think it's another good tool. As far as, I would say the one that changes the course of it the most would maybe be rhinoscopy.
Fair.
Endoscopy definitely is helpful in, you know, like GI endoscopy for biopsies is definitely helpful in older cats where, like, they are not going to survive anesthesia if we do a exploratory, but we still want some information.
Yeah.
They wake up beautifully. They're not, you know, just minimal pain meds needed, and it's great, and they recover great. Rhinoscopy, if you have a chronic sneezing cat, it's just really nice to know that they do or don't have a tumor in there or fungal plaques or something like that need to be flushed out. So I think rhinoscopy is probably the one that can change the course of treatment the most.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned CSU as a good resource. There are some obviously endoscopy books. In terms of specific quality feline medicine, what resources would you recommend to average Joes like us to maybe access in the future if we have a sick cat or something we might need help with?
Yeah. Use catvets.com a lot. The AAFP, American Association of Feline Practitioners. There's tons of practice guidelines, always coming out with new ones, webinars, links to VIN rounds, that type of thing. VIN is also a good one. Every year they have a advanced feline medicine course. I use that every year to prep for my exam.
Okay.
Obviously I needed three of them together. So I wish there was three in a year. That was helpful. Yeah, that's helpful. And then for anyone that likes more international information, the ISFM, International Society of Feline Medicine, is a good resource too. It's icatcare.org.
Wonderful.
And there's a veterinary division of that.
Okay. Well, that was a great answer. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a lot.
In one breath too. That was great. So this kind of segues into the PAW project. Now, I guess you'd probably do a much better job of explaining it, but you know, this of course revolves around declawed cats and education. Please tell us about it.
Okay. The PAW project was started by Dr. Jenny Conrad in California in the early to mid 2000s to educate the public and veterinarians about declawing and some of the things she was seeing in large cats. And so, because she does exotics and large cats at that time mostly, and she was seeing a lot of declawed cats, big cats, and they were having problems. And so she started it, and then it took her, you know, a good 10 years to really get some people to notice what was going on. She got several cities in California to ban declawing. And I joined in 2013 or 2014, something like that. Yeah, we call it a state director. Then I was in Indiana. Now I'm in Texas. We just kind of serve as a point for education, questions, case reviews on declawed cats having problems, what can be done. And I think mainly now we're just trying to get the public to see this as well, because we still have a lot of pushback. I mean, it was definitely worse when I was in the Midwest than it is here in Texas, at least in Houston. You know, I'm in the city.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, just telling people the possible side effects. We don't know all of them either. And a lot of side effects we see, we don't know why they have them. So I like to do research and I like to know why, and I like to know where things come from. So that's kind of what I focused my efforts on. Everybody has their thing.
Yeah.
Some people like the legal aspect of it. Some people like the get out in the public type of aspect, and I like the research. So, you know, I try to collect data and write papers if I can, and get people, you know, other academics involved if they can help out with like biostats and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. More recently, they came out with a new documentary. There was an initial one in 2013, just called The Paw Project.
Huh.
The new one is called American Cats, The Good, The Bad, The Cuddly.
Okay. Very cool.
It was just premiered at the Toronto, it was an international film festival. Mm-hmm. It's coming out. I'm not sure when it's going to be available, but okay. That's kind of the latest on that part.
You mentioned that you had a research paper on the declawing of cats, and you used that mm-hmm. as your second case report, correct? So kind of segue also into like your interest with surgery. I noticed that, you know, on your profile, you noted that you'll have salvage surgical procedures for declawed cats to help with their pain. What typically is the procedure? What does that entail?
Well, it depends what the cat has going on. More times than not, it's removing a piece of the P3 yeah. bone that was left behind. That's 99% of it. Sometimes there were a couple of cases where I would take the paw pads, like the paw pads were like down here instead of over the P2. So I would try to like pull the paw pads up to at least get that, give them some cushion. That is something that can be done too if it's really severe. A lot of cats will form these like big nasty calluses when they don't have a paw pad over that P2 that's left over. Some will have some contracture too. I don't do tenectomies or anything like that. But if I'm taking out the bone fragment and they do have contracture of that deep digital flexor tendon, I'll just cut it back a little bit wherever it's attached strangely, which can happen. Mm-hmm. Just stretching those toes and, you know, moving the toes is the best thing to help the contracture, I think. You can, there is a paper out there about doing tenectomies in cats that have severe contracture after declaw, and you can do that. I just never have.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the Japan part that Remy was talking about, I wrote just in the notes that we share. So I went to Japan right after I graduated. I did a 1 month externship at one of their hospitals in Tokyo. And I explored the cat cafes. And I noticed that most of the ones I went to, they actually, the majority of their cats were declawed, particularly
really?
On their front. And I was just curious to know if you have any experience with international or foreign countries and their policies with declawing cats, or just how they go about that.
Sure. I wasn't aware of that in Japan. I just assumed that they didn't, but
maybe. You think, right? Because Japan, you know, so.
I know they're usually a little more forward towards the cats than we are, but I know in Europe, it's definitely, they're appalled anytime I talk about it. Like, well, we don't even do that here. Like, I know.
Yeah.
I know you don't do it there. And Australia is the same way. They don't do it. South America doesn't do it. It's banned in, I think, all provinces except for Ontario and Canada.
So just America.
And, yeah, New York and Maryland, I think Virginia.
Okay.
It's banned there and several cities in California. But yeah, most other places, it's not a thing.
That's kind of embarrassing for
I know it was
in America and Japan. But maybe there's a correlation with heavy plastic use and declawing cats. American, Japan, that's where it is.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I feel like, I mean, like you said, so the Paw Project was involved in multiple cities banning mm-hmm. it. Like they were the ones that really pushed for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they that's usually awesome. Help writing the legislation. They have done a great job of recruiting representatives from the government and in the state and local. Like I said, I'm not super great at the whole political legal aspect of things, mm-hmm. but I will write letters. You tell me where to send a letter and I'll write it.
Yeah, that makes sense that there's kind of a multifaceted approach that mm-hmm. has to be done, right? Like there's still all those cats out there that, like, you know, we need to make sure gonna be okay. But
yeah
fun. You mentioned your passion and interest in mentorship. Now I would assume probably there's so many, just based on the experience that you've had, I would imagine mentorship with not just people on the veterinary side, but just regular people and education for them. But to ask you directly, what exactly are your interests and who was kind of your target audience currently on your platform?
I think there's a couple different, I mean, they're mostly veterinarians or veterinary students that I help mentor. Several of them are interested in feline specialty. So I think that's, I'm not going to see my main focus, so that's a focus.
Yeah, absolutely.
They have a mentorship program through ABVP if people are interested in, you know, having someone review their cases or just give them some guidance and how they need to start, that type of thing for vet students. I've done a lot of things that were not necessarily wrong, but that caused me some undue trauma.
Yeah.
So
this is from your experiences that you're passing on.
From some of my unfortunate experiences or choices that I would love for someone to not go through and to save them from that. So I do like talking to students about stuff like that and just being a source of, they're coming out and they have a new job. They want, like, can you help me with this contract? What should I be looking for? What should I be asking for? What are some red flags? You know, that type of thing.
Yeah, you mentioned the two failures on your boards exam and you're opening up about that. Why don't we get a little bit more into that process? I can imagine, of course, there's students, everyone has to take the NAVLE and there are those who fail that. So I'm sure there's students out there who can definitely have an understanding of how that felt. Wanting this for so long, studying days and days for it, and of course, taking an 8, 10, or 12 hour test to then get the result that you didn't want. Why don't you fill me in a little bit more about that process?
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking when you're taking the test because there's always that little voice in the back of your head. It's like, what if you don't pass this? No. Or you get to a question that you don't know. You're like, oh my God, I'm going to fail.
Yeah.
Or you get several in a row where, like, well, I totally forgot to even, you know, study this subject. Where did this come from? I mean, and there were some questions on the test. Like, why is this even on the test? Oh my God. I'm going to fail. These questions don't make any sense. This question is from, you know, 1980. Why am I?
They're asking about a dog on a feline.
There was a question on the ABVP before about a ferret. And I'm like, what? Why am I answering questions about a ferret vaccine?
Don't ask me.
Luckily,
either.
I think that one was removed. But so you just go through all these emotions while you're taking it. And sometimes you're panicking and you just have to, you know, find your quiet in your brain and just focus on the one in front of you. When you get that result that you don't want, it can be, in the short term, devastating because you spent so much time studying for it. And but you have to keep in mind that devastation is temporary and the shame of it is temporary. It will get better. You will feel better, but just feel it, have your pity party, you know, cry, get over, you know, just get it all out, take the day off, go do whatever you need to do. You know, I had someone that I was in contact with that when I failed the second time, he was just like, just take a breath, take a week, take some time to let it go for a little bit. Cause I was like, I can't do this. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing it again. I can't spend a whole nother thing to fail it again. And so I gave it like a month before I even thought about it. And then I just came back like, okay, I got this far. I can't just stop doing it. I have to try again. I have one more chance because you get three chances to pass the test. Well, I'm just going to do it again.
So then what happens if you don't pass it a third time? Do you have to retake
the whole?
You have
to start all over. You have to do case reports all over. You have to resubmit a completely new application.
Wow. So that was super high stakes for your,
it was my last chance.
I mean, it sounds like you did it right though with the renting the condo out the windows open. I mean, that to me
is
like,
I figured I'm perfect. Like, okay, all stops are out. I'm doing everything I can possibly do. I'm taking days off, I'm studying, I'm relaxing. I locked myself in there by myself.
And you reached out to, it seems like, the right people to kind of help talk you down. Is that something that you find is important? Most people, if not veterinarians, who are struggling to find connection and validation from others?
Absolutely. I mean, finding someone that has been through it or through something similar. I know in the moment it feels like, oh, you don't understand and you don't understand what I'm feeling. Like, yeah, I do. I get it.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have that person where they know what you're going through. They're on the other side. They can tell you what helped them. It might not help you, but that's what helped them get through it. I think it is important to have somebody to reach out to.
I think, you know, it's probably from that experience with those mentors that probably inspire you to want to help others who are kind of following the same path, right? I would have to reflect and say the same for me.
Yeah, it's a combination of the mentors I found later on in the journey and not having a mentor early in the journey. I had a couple acquaintances, but I did not utilize their experience and availability to help me at all. I just did it myself, and that made it harder. And I would want someone else to have what I didn't.
Understandably. Well, let's move on to a kind of a little bit more about the cat practice. I know you now, you own your own practice now, correct? Or no, you're
no, it's a
corporate owned. Okay.
I'm not the manager.
Okay. Do you, just based on your degree and kind of the credentials you have, do you have some level of, is there a hierarchy that you've established in the hospital? Do you have a little bit more of like kind of medical director capability? You know, is that, where do you stand in this business?
There is a managing veterinarian, and her and I are very close.
Okay.
So we kind of rely on each other. And I think she, because she's got lots of managerial things to do. So I hope the way she sees it, she can rely on me to, you know, bring some of the medical stuff to her. You know, when I see something new or want to try something new, you know, I can keep it going and train the staff as needed if it's, you know, a new technique or something like that. So I would say that I have a good working relationship with her and quite a strong ability to be able to voice my concerns or voice my interests or help change any part of the culture or the practice.
That's
if
great.
It is beneficial.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. I feel like the dream,
autonomy
honestly,
is big.
Yeah, it really is.
Being on your own terms that you can, you know, work on only the medicine. You don't have to deal with like the other miscellaneous problems.
Yeah.
But, I mean, do you feel like, oh, sorry, go ahead.
That's all I want to do.
Yeah. No,
I mean, I don't really want to manage people. I'm not good at it. I know I'm not good at it. I'm happy training and I'm happy teaching and I'm happy learning new techniques in medicine and that type of thing. So it's, for me, it's great. It's perfect.
So you get pretty wide latitude to kind of go in whatever medical path you want in terms of, you know, modifying protocols, you know, using medications that you'd prefer to use.
I'm curious about now, because the little tidbits I've picked up about just cat mental health and just the way from check-in to check-out, the process of how you create their experience. I mean, we've talked about sedation, of course, and even the actual treatment protocols and diagnostics. But even from entering the lobby, I know that certain hospitals will, especially those that are, you know, cat friendly, will have separate lobbies. They'll alter the way their exam rooms are structured. You know, very quickly, what are some of the methods that you find are true to kind of creating the best experience for a cat coming into the hospital?
Yeah, so we rarely have clients waiting in our waiting room. We try to, I know that's not feasible everywhere, but we usually take them right into the exam room. That would be most helpful in a cat and dog practice. If you have a cat room always available, the minute someone comes in with a cat, take them into that room. So I don't have to sit in the waiting room with dogs.
Oh, no, great.
And then when they get into the exam room, we like them to leave the cat in the carrier. That way, if they're freaked out, they're not going to run circles around the room immediately and get all worked up. We can start by handling them in the carrier. A lot of times they'll do a lot of the exam in the carrier if they don't seem like they want to come out.
Okay.
I can escort the cat in the carrier. I can see their skin, their hair coat. I can do an abdominal palpation in the carrier, see most of their face. And then if they're comfortable, they're doing well, then I'll get them out, get their weight, look in their ears and mouth or whatever I can't see in there. But those couple of things, I think getting the cat to the examination are helpful.
Yeah, nice. That makes sense.
Nice.
So I guess for the next 15 years, do you have any major plans as far as, you know, do you see yourself wanting to like start your own practice again? Do you feel like you're in the real comfortable spot right now? Just, you know, kind of being able to do what you want in your own.
Yeah. Don't want my own hospital.
I mean, it makes sense.
But some of the things that I would like to do is, you know, I would like to become a safety officer, an RSO, so I can provide I-131 for cats with hyperthyroidism. So possibly, so if that's the case, then I would love to have a little area to do I-131. So we have one in all of Houston, one place that does it.
Oh, geez.
And they, yeah, it's Gulf Coast and they're huge. And yeah, it's expensive, but it's also far. It's on the complete opposite side of town. So it's like a 45-minute drive from here. And there's 7 million people in the Houston metro area and we have one I-131 clinic.
Wow.
So I'd love to be able to provide that. The other is, unfortunately, we see a lot of lymphoma. I would love to be able to provide at least chemotherapy to do like a CHOP protocol, or now there's a new one, a CMOP protocol, just that.
Okay. I would imagine, since you work for a corporate, as long as you explain to them the high potential revenue that you can bring in with I-131 and chemo, I'm sure they'd give you the thumbs up.
Yeah, well, I brought it up before. The limiting factor right now is just the space, because we're in a very small, like strip center type area. And right now there's no room for it. But if it does get to the point where we need to move to a bigger place, then yeah, we do it.
It also just makes sense from like a prestige perspective, right? Like being able to just offer a fairly comprehensive, you know, set of treatments to cats. I feel like it's impressive, right? And I feel like, especially combined with the stuff you've been doing with the Paw Project, that just, it's a very cohesive approach you're taking towards cats. So I really appreciate everything you're doing
for cats,
because I feel like the segment of the veterinary world that there's still some room to improve. And so, you know, people like you are really pushing it forward. Thank you for everything you're doing.
It seems like you'll be doing mitral valve surgery soon too.
No.
One day.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, thank you so much for really being a part of this. Is there anything in particular that you wanted to share with the audience that you're passionate about, that you're currently working on?
I've been working with BasePaws, the company that does the genetic testing for cats and dogs. They're trying to develop things about the oral microbiome. They're gathering information. Right now, we're just kind of at the information gathering stage about trying to decipher, based on the oral microbiome, if we can alter or diagnose inflammatory versus lymphoma intestinal disease. Whether it's something that can be altered to prevent the progression of it, I don't know. But that's kind of where we're at. So again, with my interest in GI health, I just really want people to know that cats are not supposed to vomit. They're not birds of prey. They're not owls that puke up the hair after they eat their mice. They're supposed to swallow it and poop it out. So, you know, when you see that cat that's vomiting once a week, that's not normal. Yeah. Figure it out.
Okay.
Change the diet. Give them a puzzle feeder. Do something simple. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got to stop it there so it doesn't get to the point where I have to do a CHOP protocol on a cat.
Understandable.
Do you think that, well, now I'm really curious about the study there. Do you feel like the evaluation with the oral microbiome, like, or is the hypothesis thinking that potentially dietary modifications going to be beneficial, or is it like supplementation of something? Like, where are we kind of thinking,
you know,
this
I'm not
might
sure.
Go?
You know, usually when there's a drug company involved, they want like a supplement.
True.
That can alter it. My main interest is the diagnosis of it. Is there a difference? Can that be part of everything else? Like, say someone or the cat isn't able to undergo surgery to get biopsies. Is that part of the whole package of things where you can swab the mouth and say, well, you have a lot of this bacteria or none of this bacteria. So the likelihood that you have a lymphoma is higher.
Yeah.
And so maybe we should do the chlorambucil right off the bat.
I see.
Or,
okay.
It, you know, is it something where it's like, this looks pretty normal. It's probably inflammatory. Let's just go conservative for now.
You know, Nicole, I love the fact that you have a particular role that you want and you're good at it. And that's it. Like you don't want, there's no the political BS, nothing else. You just want to research, you want to do your practice, and you're just so darn good at it. That's amazing.
Yeah, I like the questions and I like the answers. So yeah. That's what I'm going to keep doing.
Final question here. All right. Or actually final segment. Let's go on to our OMA sarcoma. All right. So very quickly again, OMA, something that you currently are kind of into, something you dig, something positive in your life, sarcoma, a little bit more negative.
Sure.
Closed sarcomas. My OMA is, I just got back from Lyon, actually from France. We did a Paris to Lyon to Nice with our 9-month-old child.
How'd that go?
Really well. The best, number one is, if you're under 2, you fly for free. So
nice.
That was cool.
Okay.
And we had some credit card points to afford the flight, which is nice. And we brought a grandma, so she was able to help take care of the baby. So there was like our last night, we had like a nice little date night that we haven't had for a while, especially
nice.
In France. But the reason why we went is because my wife is, she's a very big Taylor Swift fan. So we were able to go to the Eras tour. And the cost of the entire trip, hotel, flight, tickets, was essentially the same cost as you getting the worst seats in a stadium, and we got VIP seats. So,
nice.
Super big OMA. I think it was a great time.
I would say.
And so, you guys can try to top that. But
how are we supposed to follow that up?
Sure, I can follow that. Okay, I guess I have 3, if that's okay.
Yeah.
One is gardening. I love gardening and growing herbs and that type of thing. And I've been a big smoothie junkie. So, putting all that into my smoothies. 2, I also really love Conan O'Brien.
Yeah.
Conan O'Brien needs a friend.
Yes.
My favorite podcast. I've loved him since I was a teenager. I watched him since I was in middle school. So it's awesome to see him having more success.
And is it his recent HBO Max special?
The HBO Max special, yeah, and the podcast.
Do you watch his Hot Things?
Mm-hmm.
That was
He's
epic.
Ridiculous.
It was so
He's
good.
Ridiculous.
He was, yeah, absurd. No, big, yeah. Big Coco fan as well.
Good. Yeah, he's good. And the third one is Hot Works, which is it's one of my things to help my mental health in this space. It is a isometric workout that you do in a sauna.
Oh, nice.
So it's like this little boutique workout space where it's a small little sauna with, you can fit 3 people in there and you do this thing on the screen. It's like a half an hour isometric workout in the sauna and you sweat your behind off and you come out and you just feel empty. It's such a wonderful feeling. I recommend anyone.
Cool.
You're so miserable. You're doing it.
When did Houston become bougie and LA? Oh.
When you get out, you just feel empty and it's lovely.
That's amazing. Okay. Hot Works.
I have to see if there's one in Florida.
Hot Works.
I know.
Yeah. That's actually just going outside.
And all right, in Florida, pretty much.
Oh, that sounds really awesome. Yeah, I don't think I can follow up any of... I was on a boat trip. I was on a boat.
You saw Eric Andre.
Oh, God, don't even start. No, that...
Not the same level as Conan O'Brien, but...
No,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what happened during that show. Not safe for the podcast.
Fair.
But the boat trip was fun. It was a good break from work. Because I'm in the habit now of basically just working 7 days a week. So,
no, don't do that.
Yeah. So the boat was my nice reprieve from it. But yeah, it was nice being out in the ocean and saw a manatee.
That's a big
one. We saw 2 dolphins. And then we saw like one of those, I'm blanking on the name of the, it's not a stingray. It's one of the little, it's a different type of stingray, but it did like a little jump out of the water. So, cool little.
I'd say that's better than Taylor Swift, you know.
Oh, totally.
All marine animals. That's kind of tops it. All right. So the sarcoma, everything's revolved around my daughter now. So she is now approaching 10 months. So she's starting to hit a sleep regression. And of course, we just got back from France. So who knows if there's like, you know, some tie-in with jet lag. But because my wife is also an ER doctor, and actually she's also a behaviorist too. So I wanted to bring it up, but I didn't want to talk about my life too much because I already do enough. But so she's been on overnights the last three nights. So then I've been taking over the shifts and also, of course, doing my day job. So it's just, you know, again, this is a platform where we can also complain, share our negative feelings just to kind of get off. So that's my sarcoma.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mine is noise and chaos. Yeah, noise is definitely a sarcoma for me, namely fluid pumps, beeping.
The HESCA ones?
Yeah, yes, the HESCA ones. I have very, like, a noise sensitivity. Like, my ears are so sensitive that anytime I hear a beep and it's just going on, and I'm like, just can't take it.
That plus, like, anesthesia. Monitors beeping at you, blood pressure machine beeping at you.
You can only take one beep at a time.
Some days can be a bit rough.
That might have been our first veterinary related sarcoma, which is a really good
one. I mean, it's because it's really annoying. I love it. Some days.
Nice one. But
yeah, I'd say mine. Again, mine's kind of lame. We bought a bonsai tree because we're trying to like garden, but it's pretty much dead now because we didn't know what it wanted. The guy told us we were supposed to water it once a week and put it in low light. So we did that. And then it just started like wilting. So then we were confused. Does it need more sunlight or does it need more water? So we chose water and we chose wrong because as soon as we gave it more water, it started like showing these black spots, which the internet told us was like fungal overgrowth, which I guess shouldn't be surprising in Florida.
I have also killed a bonsai tree. It's very easy to do.
I'm learning that. It seems like everybody's had the kill a bonsai experience. So
it's now right crossed that off our list.
So now I'm in the market for new bonsai. Still have the pot, but it's officially kaput. It's
victim number two coming right up. Well, hey guys, this was a fantastic episode. Nicole, you've been so great with answering our questions, and obviously again with the ignorance, especially on my end, of really kind of understanding the field that you are so darn good at. Thanks for sharing all, you know, your experience and just having a good time with us.
Yeah, thanks for being easy to talk to. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for coming on.
All right guys, hey, we'll catch you guys on the next episode. All right, take care.